Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Our sport is a risky sport.
We are at the mercy of the mountain itself.
Rock covered in snow and ice.
The risk of avalanches from bad weather.
Hypothermia.
Altitude sickness.
Exhaustion.
It's not a natural environment for survival.
Chasing Mountains. Listen now by searching for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday the 2nd of May, these are our main stories. Riot police in Los Angeles move in to dismantle a pro-Palestinian protest on Gaza at a university campus in Los Angeles. The EU announces a $1 billion package for Lebanon. The Solomon Islands elects a new pro-Beijing prime minister. Also in this podcast, Britain's top computer scientist warns it's already too late to stop AI influencing this year's elections in the US and UK. And he was known as the King of Twang. The American rock and roll guitarist Duane Eddy has died at the age of 86. As we record this podcast, it's the early hours of the morning on the west coast of America. And after a standoff, riot police have entered a pro-Palestinian protest camp at the University of California and Los Angeles, known as UCLA. The police began demolishing barricades and shifting the protesters after they defied an order to disperse. Similar protest camps against the Israeli war in Gaza have been dismantled at other US universities in recent days, including in New York and Dallas. Our correspondent, Helena Humphrey, described the moment the police operation got underway.
Police have broken through that perimeter. They are dragging away the barricades. You can hear what appears to be fireworks right now. More of the California Highway Patrol going in. Those fireworks continuing to go off. And it appears that they may be making some arrests. Certainly people appear to be coming out with their hands tied behind their back. I can see one such protester so far, at least being escorted away from the scene. And now the police starting to pull away metal barricades. We know that plywood have been used as reinforcements throughout the course of the day. And certainly it appears to be some kind of turmoil going on right now as police just cast away those barricades that had been erected and reinforced throughout the course of the afternoon as they move in from the other side. Earlier they'd moved in from behind, we believe, essentially, and then had since retreated. But now they've come in from this other side. And, you know, a significant opening now of this area where we believe a few hundred people are still inside, despite those calls for them to disperse.
Helena Humphrey. I got the latest from our North America correspondent, Emma Vardy, who is also at the campus.
We're watching large number of officers gradually moving deeper and deeper into the encampment. It seems like their tactics have been pretty successful. They've cleared a large area of the encampment now. At different points, they're firing volleys of flashbang grenades, the loud bangs and the loud flashes to disrupt protesters, and at other points, circling groups of them and sort of corralling them into one side and allowing police to dismantle more tents and remove more barricades. We have been seeing some protesters led away with their hands tied, cable tied, it seems, behind their backs, but we're not sure really yet how many exact arrests are being made and how many people exactly are being detained. Now, earlier on, some protesters told us that police were firing rubber bullets. It's very difficult to see in all the chaos exactly what police tactics are being used in that sense. Now, the protesters still left inside. They all look pretty determined to keep resisting for as long as they can. But police have made seemingly quite a lot of progress in the last hour in clearing a big section of this encampment.
And what are people saying to you there about what's going on?
Well, it depends who you ask. I mean, the protesters themselves, I mean, they're angry. They feel that they should have a right to be able to remain in their encampment longer. They've been making various demands of the universities in terms of cutting ties with Israel or businesses that do business with Israel. Very similar to, of course, all the demands across the universities, across this wave of protests that we've seen. But in each case, there's a tolerance level, which is larger or smaller in different states as to how long they'll leave these encampments set up. And tonight was the moment that police moved in on the encampment here at UCLA. Students outside who had nothing to do with these protests, of course, who we've been talking to, some feel sympathy with them. Others are quite frustrated that a lot of classes have been cancelled. And particularly for some people who are sitting exams this week, they too feel a sort of frustration about the disruption to what would have been an important week for them.
I mean, looking at the pictures that are unfolding on the television screens here in the studio, it looks like a very big police operation.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely massive. I've walked around the whole perimeter of the encampment, and at each point there were hundreds of officers in riot gear standing ready at different points, and helicopters circling overhead, drones circling overhead. It was obviously a very well coordinated operation, and at each point they've been sort of systematically going in and clearing sections of it. And I think they're, you would think from the police's perspective, they are achieving what they set out to this evening. I'm not sure the protesters here quite knew what to expect. When we were along one side of the encampment with the protesters, they were tearing down barricades on one side, bringing them over to the other side, desperately trying to sort of hold their position, if you like. But it seems that, I would take a guess, in the next few hours, they may well have cleared this entirely if things carry on the way they are at the moment.
Emma Vardy in Los Angeles. Lebanon is a country stuck in an economic meltdown with 80% of its population living in poverty. It's a situation exacerbated by a migrant crisis and the threat of war with Israel. Now, on a visit to the capital, Beirut, the president of the EU Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has announced a financial package worth $1 billion.
We are here first and foremost to say that the European Union strongly supports Lebanon and its people, and we want to reinforce our long-standing cooperation. Today, we discussed how we can strengthen our political and economic relations and support the security and stability of Lebanon.
More from our correspondent Hugo Bachega, who's in Beirut.
This is a package of 1 billion euros to be spent in the next 3 years. And this is money that is expected to be used to improve public services, also to support the security forces. Obviously, for 5 years, Lebanon has been in a severe economic crisis, which has meant that the country has struggled to support public services. But a lot of this money is to help Lebanon deal with Syrian refugees. More than 1.5 million Syrian refugees live here in Lebanon. This has put a lot of pressure on services. There's been a lot of tension as well between refugees and some parts of the population in some places. And because of all of that, there's been a rise in the number of Syrians trying to reach Cyprus, which is a member of the EU, from Lebanon. And I think this is an effort by the EU to try to tackle this problem.
And there are ongoing military exchanges, aren't there, between Hezbollah and Israel in the south of the country. What impact is that having on Lebanon?
Well, it is affecting the entire country. More than 100,000 people have had to flee their homes along the border. Crops have been destroyed. There's been a lot of destruction in terms of houses, infrastructure in that part of the country. And here in Beirut and some other parts of the country, you don't see tourists. Tourism obviously is a vital sector of the economy. And I think there's also the psychological impact on people here because nobody knows what is going to happen. So there is this uncertainty about the future. Up until now, most of those attacks from Hezbollah and Israel have been limited to the border region between Lebanon and Israel. But there's always the risk of miscalculation. Hezbollah says that there is a ceasefire in Gaza. There will be a ceasefire here as well. There's been a lot of diplomatic activity to try to come up with a deal. The Americans have been involved. But again, I don't think the situation is going to change here unless there is a ceasefire or even the end of the war in Gaza.
Hugo Bachega. The head of the United States military command in Africa says discussions are continuing with the authorities in Niger and Chad, despite the fact that US troops have been withdrawing. The Sahel region has suffered from persistent attacks by Islamic extremist groups, and in recent months, countries across the area, including those under military rule, have been turning to Russia for military cooperation instead of to Western allies. Chris Ewakor reports.
Dozens of American special forces who were stationed at an airbase in Chad have pulled out of the country. This happened after the military government there raised concerns over their presence. In an interview with the BBC, the head of the U.S. Africa Command said this was a temporary withdrawal. General Michael Langley also said discussions were continuing with the military in Niger. Like military-run Mali, Niger has forced U.S., French and U.N. troops to leave and has also turned to Moscow for help against Islamist extremist groups. Some analysts suggest this switch of allegiance is at least partly aimed at protecting the military regimes.
Chris Ewakor. India's general election is underway, and among those heading to the polls will be 18 million new first-time voters. So, what are the most pressing election issues for them? Our South Asia correspondent Samir Hussain has been speaking to young people in two different parts of the country.
Okay, so should I try it? Should I take a sip first and then see if I like it? Okay. Oh, that's tasty. I'm with first-time voters here in Kerala, sitting next to the beach, and we're drinking coconut water, and I want to understand what are the most important issues for first-time voters here.
We're losing this thing between communities. We're losing the secularism that we are proud of in our constitution. So I want to maintain what we used to be.
Important to me is to provide more job opportunity in our country.
How do you guys get your news?
Local TV channels.
Instagram, Facebook.
Instagram, social media, just like that.
I prefer following journalists on Instagram who have credibility.
Can you tell me, what is it that you would like to see changed in this country?
We want to change the caste discrimination in the country. That's the main problem.
I don't want them to fighting over caste, religion and all that kind of stuff. I want them fighting for money. You see, that's when the economy grows, and I believe that's what's needed.
One side, you see a lot of rich people flaunting in their cars, you know, just very big cities like Mumbai, etc. And then while you're in cities like that, you see children coming into the road. They're, you know, knocking on your windows and asking for money. There are slums, and there's right besides that, there are, you know, big rich people living. So there's a big difference between in the same place.
So that's some of what we're hearing from first-time voters in Kerala. I've now come to Bihar, which is in North India. We're in the capital of Patna. And I'm with a few first-time voters here to get a sense of what the issues are for them and whether there are any differences.
The major issue that we are having in this country is employment. I feel like I should have an option to just work in the city that I was born in. They should not just set their offices in the main cities.
As a woman who's traveling regularly on public transport, I think safety should be there. You're always on guard. Last month, I'd say, there was a guy, he was like tingling behind my thighs, and I slapped that guy. Like, what was that? Sometimes you just want to be free and put your earphones on and just go home without thinking, like, what the other person sitting beside me doing. So I want that to women to feel safe and they can travel safely.
There should be more women political leaders. She will actually provide at least some mental peace to women.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's high time that we should start educating boys on how to behave and how to sit.
Do you think the politicians care about things like education and unemployment?
Yes, definitely. They discuss about it. They do research about it. But working is something that they are not doing.
I want to know, where do all of you get your news from?
TV channels.
Newspaper.
Social media.
Social media, Instagram.
Social media is the biggest source, by the way.
Why social media? Like, what's up with that?
It's like where we spend most of our time on.
You get your informations more easily and quickly, like one tap away. It's just one click away.
One click away to the desired info you want.
Samira Hussain. As well as India, there will also be elections this year in the UK and the US. But according to one of Britain's top computer scientists, there's a serious risk that artificial intelligence could be misused to influence the outcome. Professor Dame Wendy Hall told the BBC that voters will have to be on their guard against convincing deepfakes of politicians shared on social media.
The deepfakes that are coming out now, particularly those that are using generative AI, which is quite hard to do. It's not off-the-shelf technology at the moment. They're very mature and it's very difficult to tell technically or even looking at them whether it's a fake or not. The official campaigns need to put their stamp on things. We will get watermarking over time and we will get technology that will help with this, but not in time for this year's election. So social media, of course, amplifies things. And we need to have a public awareness campaign about, you know, being very careful about what information they trust.
For more, I spoke to our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
Well, she's right, isn't she? There's no magic off button for the misuse of AI. Let's start with a look at a non-political story that we saw in the last few weeks. There were some fake images of Taylor Swift that went viral online. And in the end, so many people were looking at them and sharing them and reposting them that the platform X, formerly Twitter, had to block all searches of her across the whole platform to stop people from finding it. Now, clearly, that's not possible, is it, on a sort of grand political scale? And there's a really interesting bit of research done by Stanford University in the US. They showed a group a series of statements, and about a quarter of them believed those statements without seeing anything else. This went up to about 40% when they saw the statements, and they also saw some disinformation that had been written by humans. And that figure went up to 53% of them who believed it when they saw the statements, and they also saw disinformation that had been written by AI and then tweaked by students. And the AI tool that they used was one that we've all got access to. It was ChatGPT. So that's the power of how influential this material, this content can be.
So what's been done to counter it?
It is a really difficult game of cat and mouse. And of course, it's been going on for a long time. You know, what we're seeing here is an old world problem playing out with a set of very new tools. Meta in particular, which owns Facebook and Instagram, is telling genuine political campaigners that they have to flag their content if they are using AI themselves. Because let's not forget, it is genuinely being used for authentic reasons as well. There are also tech tools the social networks are building, which can recognize this content. And of course, on top of all of that, we've got regulation. So lots of countries are considering or even bringing in strict rules about social media and what's shared on it. In the UK, we have the Online Safety Act, and that forces social networks to remove disinformation as soon as they're made aware of it. And the penalties for that are very, very big fines. But I don't think there's any way, certainly at this stage, to put that genie back in the bottle.
And just thinking about this myself, I mean, is there anything that if you're looking at anything on social media, is there any pointer that you should look out for which might suggest if something is fake or not?
I wish I could give you three top tips, but the fact is that this technology is getting so good that it's getting harder. Deepfake videos, the eyes didn't used to blink, now they do. Deepfake audio, you didn't used to hear a person taking a breath, now you do. You can do little things. Sometimes you can have a look at the background. Sometimes if an image has been rendered or a video has been rendered by artificial intelligence, what's in the background can be less polished. If you're looking at video, watch the mouth, see if it perfectly syncs with the audio that you're hearing. But honestly, these are not 100% foolproof. So I think voters this year, which is apparently half of the world, isn't it, are going to have to really be on their guard.
Zoe Kleinman. Still to come.
She was older when she died, so her teeth were really worn down. I mean, the teeth at the front, she's got no crown left to the white part. She had gum disease and the gums would have been starting to recess. We can see also things like signs of arthritis in her neck.
Scientists recreate the face of a Neanderthal woman 75,000 years after her death.
I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the debate around what to do with around $300 billion of Russian money frozen as part of Western sanctions against the Kremlin. Political backing is growing for at least some of those funds to pay for Ukraine's war effort. But would this break international law and potentially put off investment from other major players? Just search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Politicians in the Solomon Islands have chosen a new prime minister who's in favour of closer ties with China. Jeremiah Minelli won a vote by fellow members of parliament. His main opponent wanted to curb Beijing's influence in the Pacific. The contest took place after a general election last month failed to produce a clear winner. Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Mickey Bristow, told me more.
The main reason that we're talking about him and the main reason that most people across the world are interested in is the international relations aspect of this story. The Solomon Islands, subject to great power rivalry between China, the United States and Australia. Mr. Minelli favours China. So 2 years ago, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact, controversial security pact with Beijing. Mr. Minelli was part of the administration which drew close to China. And so it's expected that now he will maintain that close relationship with Beijing. But of course, you ask me what kind of person he is. People in the Solomon Islands aren't just concerned about international relations. The economy, he spoke about that, getting that going, mining, logging, and also improving the health and education for people, for the nearly million people who live in the Solomon Islands. A lot of them spread out across hundreds of small islands. So very specific issues facing this country, which he's going to tackle.
And what are the implications of his stance for the wider region?
Yeah, just going back to what I said there at the beginning about the relationship with China, the Solomon Islands, not just the Solomon Islands, but also other Pacific nations really come under pressure from other bigger nations because of this great power rivalry. They see the Pacific as an area to compete. And in some respects, these smaller countries have been, if not victims, then certainly at the centre of this power struggle. So at the moment, this election won't really change that power balance. However, the new prime minister has a reputation of being a conciliatory kind of character, so he's probably going to maintain good relations with Beijing, but also have better relations with Australia and the United States than his predecessor did. So perhaps not a great change in the foreign policy of this region.
I mean, interesting how he's asked people, appealed to people to accept the result.
Yeah, there has been a lot of violence in the Solomons over previous years, particularly following elections. There was violence a few years ago about this switch towards China. And so that appeal there is about for people to just accept the result. Let's get on and try and sort some of the problems out in the Solomon Islands. I expect he's hoping to forget about foreign policy altogether.
Mickey Bristow. India's food regulator has ordered nationwide inspections of companies making spice mixes, following allegations that two brands popular overseas had problems with contamination. More from Anbarasan Etherajan.
Officials in India have been ordered to carry out testing of all the manufacturing units for powdered spices, with a focus on those making curry powders and mixed spice blends. Food safety inspectors in Hong Kong last month suspended sales of three spice blends made by MDH and another by Everest over allegedly high levels of ethylene oxide, a cancer-causing chemical. Singapore also ordered a recall of the same Everest spice mix for fish curry. The two companies have said the products are safe for consumption.
Anbarasan Etherajan. The number of BBC World Service journalists working in exile is estimated to have nearly doubled in the past 4 years to 310. The figures, released for the first time ahead of World Press Freedom Day, reflect the growing challenges journalists face in countries like Russia, Afghanistan and Ethiopia. Some journalists, including those from Iran, have lived abroad for more than a decade. Stephanie Hegarty spoke to some of those facing death threats, harassment and jail sentences just for doing their job.
My husband and I bought the cheapest airplane tickets outside of Russia, and we didn't actually pick any destination in particular, just out.
Nina Nazarova works for BBC Russian and had to leave her home following the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in early 2022.
BBC News at 6 o'clock. The BBC has temporarily suspended its operations in Russia.
My husband and I took two suitcases, our son and his stroller, and left. When our plane was taken off, my husband looked outside the plane window and actually cried, and I just went numb.
It was the 4th of March, and a new censorship law had come into effect in Russia.
And after that, I could face up to 15 years in prison just for doing my job.
In April this year, her colleague, BBC Russian correspondent Ilya Barabanov, was labelled as a foreign agent Ilya and the BBC reject the decision and are disputing it in court. But Ilya, Nina and their team now live in the Latvian capital, Riga. And like 310 other BBC World Service staff, they may never be able to go home.
It's been difficult. First few years, it was more difficult because you think all the time that I want to go back. You feel that you can go back.
Farnaz Ghazizadeh, a presenter for BBC Persian, hasn't been home to Iran in 21 years.
My dad, when he was alive, they summoned him regularly to threaten him. They told them that they know where our children's schools are.
Recently, she learned by chance, after a hack on the Iranian judiciary, that she and nine of her colleagues have been sentenced to a year in prison.
I dream about going back. I try not to think about it because it can destroy you.
In 2022, when her brother fell seriously ill, Farnaz was desperate to get home. He died 6 weeks later.
And then 6 months on, my father passed. Still, I am struggling with that. I really wanted to be there for my family, for my mother, and I couldn't be there.
For Shazia Haya from BBC Pashto, life in exile is also laced with guilt. She was evacuated to the UK alone in 2022 when the Taliban took control in Afghanistan, leaving her parents and her brother in Kabul.
I mean, I can't explain the night. I left home around 2 a.m. I don't know why I couldn't hug my younger brother. And I'm regretting that. My brother's not free. I'm free in here, but he's not.
The Committee to Protect Journalists sees risks increasing for journalists globally. Jody Ginsburg is their CEO.
It is much worse for journalists than it has been for a very long time. We've got near record numbers of journalists in jail. The killing of journalists reached a high not seen since 2015, and many colleagues report ongoing harassment.
But to be honest with you, I watch my back. I have a lot of security camera around my house.
TR Gol is a correspondent for BBC Persian.
And even I was warned it would be smart to change my daughter's school.
In March, a presenter for the independent broadcaster Iran International was stabbed in the leg outside his London home. And British counterterrorism police have warned of an increased threat to BBC Persian staff in the UK.
My grave worry is one day she will be without father. My wife passed away and said, oh my gosh, if something happened to me, what's going to happen to my daughter? That something is really in the back of my mind always. I'm more cautious.
He hasn't been to Iran since 2007. When his mother died, he snuck over the border to visit her grave. He didn't go to her funeral. But what many of these journalists find even more frustrating is having to report on their countries from afar. And as journalists covering what's happening at home, they're inextricably linked to the places they've had to leave.
You cannot really live your life feeling that, okay, I'm British now, I'm leaving this country. This is not how it works. You are in exile and still you're there.
Farnaz Ghazizadeh ending that report by Stephanie Hegarty. Scientists at Cambridge University have recreated the face of a Neanderthal woman who lived 75,000 years ago. The lifelike model was built from a crushed skull discovered in a cave in Kurdistan, where the remains of at least 10 Neanderthals have been found since the 1950s. Scientists think she may have been in her mid-40s, a considerable age at that point. James Copnell spoke to Dr. Emma Pomeroy, a paleoanthropologist at the University of Cambridge, who worked on the project.
Our role here was in making the physical reconstruction of the skull. And then the Kennis brothers, who are fabulous paleo artists, have done the reconstruction of what she would have looked like during life. But just to reconstruct the skull was a huge challenge. It was completely crushed. It was about 2 centimetres thick in total and highly fragmented. The bone was very soft. So we had to remove the bone from the ground in small packages and then very carefully clean that in the lab, add a consolidant, which is kind of like a glue that helps to stabilize the bone and make it strong enough to work with, and then set about the quite daunting task of physically fitting those bits of the bone back together.
What does this then reveal about the person who died so many years ago?
We're learning a lot from the skull itself, and this is actually work that's ongoing, but we can already say, well, we know that she's female. We can also say that she was older when she died, so her teeth were really worn down. I mean, the teeth at the front, she's got no crown left to the white part. They're worn right down to little stubs of the roots. We're also learning about her health, so For example, she had gum disease and the gums would have been starting to recess. We can see also things like signs of arthritis in her neck. So very exciting to start learning about this person. The physical reconstruction, so what she would have looked like in life, is also quite fascinating because I think it helps us to think of her as a person and brings up some different questions about what she might have been like and what her life might have been like.
And other things that have surprised you then in this work over the last couple of years?
Yes, I mean, various things. One of the most interesting points, I think, is that Shandar Zed is actually part of a really tight cluster of Neanderthal individuals found in the cave. And that's very intriguing because the cave is huge. And yet within sort of a metre and a half by a metre by 50 centimetres deep, we've got the remains of at least five individuals. So that starts raising questions. I don't think it can be coincidence in such a big space. So does this have some kind of meaning? Are they returning to that same spot? And actually, we're getting some evidence that the bodies were brought there or placed there at different times. So again, it raises this question of whether Neanderthals had sort of special places and how they thought about death and the landscape around them.
I mean, would that suggest a sort of a more empathy, emotion than one might have associated with Neanderthals?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, from sort of the earliest days back to the 19th century when Neanderthals were first identified, there was this idea that they were sort of your archetypal cavemen, not very intelligent and not capable of things like compassion and very complex emotions. But in more recent years, that idea has been challenged. And actually, the finds here from Shandar Cave have been really instrumental in that. And the new finds will play an important part in us trying to understand their capacity for compassion and how they might have dealt with death.
Dr. Emma Pomeroy. One of the greats of early rock and roll, Duane Eddy, has died at the age of 86. He'd been diagnosed with cancer. A pioneer of the twangy guitar sound, Duane Eddy enjoyed a series of instrumental hits in the late 1950s and early 60s and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1994. Our arts correspondent David Sillitoe looks back at his life.
Duane Eddy, Peter Gunn and the twang, his utterly distinctive guitar style. The sound, he said, was an echo of where he grew up. Desolate, arid Arizona.
There's something about the guitar and the sound of it and everything. It just kind of smacks of the Southwest and the wide open spaces.
He had a run of hits in the 50s and 60s. In the 80s, The Art of Noise took him back into the charts. And his final album was recorded in his 70s with Sheffield's Richard Hawley, a long-time admirer who said one note from that Gretsch guitar was all you needed to hear to know you are listening to Duane Eddy.
Well, another admirer was guitarist and singer-songwriter Martin Simpson, who met him in 2011 when he came to the UK.
Duane was such an extraordinarily nice human being, as well as being really one of the complete progenitors of the electric guitar as a larger thing in society, I believe.
And did he play a gig with you? I mean, when he came, when you met him, what was he doing?
Well, he played big gigs. He played Glastonbury,
of course,
that year. But he also played at my local pub, which is the Greystones here in Sheffield, which, you know, stands 200 people and seats 110 sort of thing. So to stand at the very front of the stage listening to that sound. What a sound. What a fabulous sound.
I know. I bet the punters couldn't believe it. You talked about him as one of the progenitors. The word I keep reading in these obituaries I'm seeing online is a pioneer. Just explain to us, if you would, Martin, why Duane Eddy was such a key figure in the development of rock and roll.
Well, he was, to start with, I think, the first guitar hero. There weren't people like him, I should say, at that point. Nobody had heard these big-sounding instrumental records. It was really before Surf. He had a massive influence on, for instance, Hank Marvin, who became a massively influential guitar player over here. But if you think about what Hank Marvin did, in many ways, Duane Eddy is the obvious inspiration for that. So, you know, the electric guitar is now the biggest instrument in the world. And one of the people that started that was Dwayne.
And can you explain for the non-guitarists among us, can you explain that twang? Technically, what was going, how, what is the twang? How did he make it? What was the skill required?
Well, I mean, he was playing a really beautiful 1950s Gretsch Chet Atkins guitar, which has a really extraordinary sound on its own. But then that sound was run into a very big amp with lots of bass response. And he played on the bass strings. And his producer, Lee Hazelwood, he had an enormous water tank, which he used as an echo chamber. And so part of the charm of that guitar sound is the fact that it was recorded in a water tank.
Martin Simpson talking to Amol Rajan about Dwayne Eddy, who's died at the age of 86. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy. The producer was Judy Frankel. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the debate around what to do with around $300 billion US of Russian money frozen as part of Western sanctions against the Kremlin. Political backing is growing for at least some of those funds to pay for Ukraine's war effort. But would this break international law and potentially put off investment from other major players? Just search for the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.